This week in Retronauts, we're Rudy Tooty, Fresh and Spoony. All right, everyone. Yeah. Hi. I don't know what just happened, but it was
the least worst option.
Hello. Welcome to another episode of Retronauts. I'm Jeremy Parrish, and this week we're going to talk about Final Fantasy IV. But you might know it as Final Fantasy II because you haven't been keeping up to date.
It's also Doki Doki Panic in Japan. I'm sorry. I use that joke too much. I'm Bob Mackey, and this is an HD remake of a Final Fantasy IV episode we did in 2012.
I don't remember that one. Was I on that?
You were on it, yeah. It was your grand return to Retronauts.
Oh, my God. I think that would be important or something. After the Sonic episode?
Yes, yes. Actually, I think it was.
Is there anything new to say about Retronauts after that?
About Retronauts?
Or about Final Fantasy IV?
I forgot all of it.
Nope. Close it all up.
And these two folks were probably not on it.
Should we just paste this episode into that?
What's that?
Should we just, like, stop talking now and paste that episode in and be like, yeah, wow, it seems really familiar.
That was back when I was young and hopeful, so I don't think so. I think it'll be too much.
Now you're old and listless.
Yeah.
Who else is here with us?
Hi, I am Chris Kohler, Easy Type.
That's not what I've heard, Chris.
And?
And I've been Cat Bailey, and I've been ported to the Wonder Swan. Woo!
Congratulations!
Yay!
No one will ever buy you.
Oh.
So, sorry.
Oh my god!
Knife to the heart, man. Jeez.
It's not my fault that you're on Wonder Swan. It's not your fault that Wonder Swan is a disaster. Don't feel bad about it. It's just how it goes. So anyway, yes, we're talking about the fourth Final Fantasy game as part of our extensive series of deep dives into the Final Fantasy franchise. We did Final Fantasy I last summer, and we're not doing Final Fantasy II or III because it's just hard to say that much about them. We will talk about Final Fantasy III this episode.
Although, have you guys seen that Hironobu Sakaguchi has been live streaming Final Fantasy III on Nico Nico?
No way.
He has been, I think it's part of like, it's some sort of a Famitsu like tie up kind of promotion thing, but Sakaguchi has been playing through Final Fantasy III on what I'm guessing is probably a Famicom Mini, and live streaming it. How cool is that?
Pretty rad.
Yeah. I thought we did talk about two,
we talked about one and then briefly about two, but it was really mostly focused on
one's
one.
More important.
And that's what we're going to kind of do here is talk briefly about three and then mostly focus on four. Because I do think that Final Fantasy III, like understanding that game is important to understanding Final Fantasy IV, because Final Fantasy IV really builds on III, a lot of the concepts, if not the systems. If you look at some of the early Final Fantasy games, it really feels like each one was kind of a reaction to the last, and tried to sort of push the series in a different direction. Final Fantasy II, you know, took the original game and went with more of a story format, more of an open-ended format, gave you named characters and a more guided plot. Three went more back to the first game style where you had four generic characters and the idea of class graduation, basically like moving from one job class to another, became integral to the plot instead of like a side quest. Final Fantasy IV then takes all those jobs and classes that Final Fantasy III invented and turns them into characters. It gives them definition and gives them a role in a story to play. So Final Fantasy III came out in 1990 for the Nintendo Famicom and never came to America, well, until many years later in a different format. But it was kind of – I sort of see it as Final Fantasy's attempt to do Dragon Quest III. You know, Dragon Quest III was really all about the job systems or classes or whatever you want to call it. And III was much more, you know, like the sort of Final Fantasy adaptation of that concept. Chris, you probably know III best of anyone here. That would be my guess, my assumption.
I know about III. I've done research about III, but I've never actually sat down and played through III. I mean, I played the DS remake of III.
Yeah, I did too.
But that's not Final Fantasy III, right? I mean,
it's
that's
totally
like,
different.
Yeah.
Yeah, Final Fantasy III Famicom fans will have you believe that Final Fantasy III for DS is a very, very different game, right. A completely different game mm-hmm. that happens to share the same plot beats.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I know of Final Fantasy III that it's considered very difficult, especially towards the end.
Yeah, the final dungeon is ridiculous.
It is.
Even in the DS version.
But, I mean, I love the music from Final Fantasy III. And I know a lot about the jobs that you have. Like, I'm really into the idea of Final Fantasy III.
Well, that's really
maybe
the most important part.
Maybe I should play
part.
Final Fantasy III. Maybe III. So. Yeah, maybe I should.
Now that it's on Famicom Mini.
Yeah.
Assuming you can find one of those.
I would probably honestly just play the fan-translated ROM so I wasn't sitting there, like, trying to read hiragana, which is, like, really difficult.
Yeah. Yeah. Fair enough.
Yep.
It's a good choice.
Mm-hmm.
So has anyone played Final Fantasy III on Famicom?
I played the fan translation whenever it came out, like in 2099 or whatever. And I mean,
2099.
And it comes out in the future, and I've been there. No, the year 2000 or 1999, and it is a difficult game. I believe I save-stated my way through some tough parts, and I think I finished it. I was a teenager. I played a lot of these, so I can't remember all the details. But I did play through the DS version as well when that came out. And that was also the first Retronauts episode, too.
I played the DS version, and I think I was living in Japan. It was like 2006 or something. And I was like, oh, man, this is really dry, like the story-wise, even with kind of the broader story even than the Famicom version because they added a whole bunch of it. And at the time, I was like, whoa, they have cutscenes in DS games? That's crazy.
Full motion video.
And they had a job system. But honestly, I don't remember it very well because it bored me. Like crazy, and I could only get about halfway through it, and frankly, I don't remember a thing about it. It like just totally washed over me. So that goes to show like how much of an impression Final Fantasy III left on me, which is to say, it didn't really leave one at all.
The impression it left on me was this dungeon needs a save point. The last dungeon, they didn't add one. So if you die to one of the several bosses in that dungeon, you lose all of your progress. You go back to before you enter the dungeon if you saved before you enter the dungeon. So after dying in that dungeon, I was like, no, I beat this game. I consider it beaten. Goodbye. Go back to Gamefly from whence you came. Yeah.
Here's the thing that I find interesting is that Final Fantasy III came out in Japan in 1990. That was the same year that Final Fantasy I came out in the U.S.
That's true.
That is true. Yeah.
And they planned, I mean, Square, basically they were going to do the handoff, like where Nintendo published Final Fantasy in the U.S., and then Square was going to do the rest of them. And Square's initial
there's marketing materials out there
for 2 and 3. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so they were really going to do it. And then they were like, oh, look, the bottom just is like falling out.
Yeah.
Of the market.
Let's make this Game Boy game. Let's call it Final Fantasy.
Actually, Kat, both Dragon Quest and Final Fantasy came out in America after their third games came out in Japan. Mm-hmm. So we kind of missed the few.
That's right.
Yeah. Indeed.
I feel like Final Fantasy held up a little bit better than Dragon Warrior.
Sure. Yeah,
maybe
that's
why it was a little more popular in the U.S. when it first came out.
Well, yeah, I mean, it had better graphics and better music. And
yeah, both of them were pretty unpopular.
Final Fantasy did pretty well.
They were never popular.
Final Fantasy 1 did pretty well.
I actually knew what Final Fantasy was versus like Dragon Warrior. Like I was kind of peripherally aware of Dragon Warrior.
I assume they were both a big deal because Nintendo Power wrote about them a lot. So that was my metric.
With Final Fantasy 1, Nintendo Power did do a like colossal
And the guide.
The contest, like win a Palantir basically.
Yep. And so I was not So when Final Fantasy I came out, they sent me that guide because that had to have been, let's see, my first issue of Nintendo Power was the Mario 3 guide, which means that my fifth issue of Nintendo Power was the Final Fantasy guide. I definitely was like, oh, I totally want to play this game. It sounds so interesting. And we got Final Fantasy I at like a yard sale or something like that, and I started playing it, and I got to the Marsh Cave, and I was like, what is up with this game being so hard? Like, I didn't get grinding. You know, I was like, what? Nobody ever explained to me that that was a thing you had to do. So I just thought this game was just like stupidly difficult and I put it down.
So my recollection of the kind of the legacy of Final Fantasy III was that like a lot of people said that it kind of pushed the NES to the limits. Like that was like kind of the best expression of the series on the NES from a mechanical standpoint.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you know what? They originally, when the WonderSwan came out, they were like, oh, we're going to do Final Fantasy III on the WonderSwan. They got as far as mocked up screenshots and things like that. And I was like, oh, great, because I played Final Fantasy I on the WonderSwan. I was like, I'll finally get to play Final Fantasy III. And it was too big for the WonderSwan.
I've been told that they lost the source code to Final Fantasy III. And that's why we never got a proper original remake.
What I had heard was that it was just there was just too much data. There was just, they couldn't put it on a WonderSwan cartridge. Yeah.
I find that hard to believe, honestly.
Really?
I mean, this was a cartridge 10 years later. I feel like memory capacity had increased quite a bit.
Yeah.
They got Final Fantasy IV on there.
But they saved the source code for Final Fantasy 1 and 2 and 4 and they lost 3? Is that what they're saying?
I mean, is 3 really a bigger game than 4?
I don't think they have the source for anything.
I don't know.
Yeah.
This is what I've been told.
Right.
Anyway, I would say that Final Fantasy 3 has two legacies that kind of really matter for this series and its evolution. The first is the job system. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there was a rudimentary job system in Final Fantasy I. You had, you know, you picked your four classes.
Right.
And midway through the game, you could go meet up with Bahamut.
Right.
And become a better class, like a better version of that class.
But that was not that different from other RPGs.
Right.
Where you had character
classes. Whereas Final Fantasy III had, like, free class swapping, like Dragon Quest III did. But
job
even
change,
yeah, job change. It was even more baked into the concept of the game. There were prestige classes. It was very involved. And the second element I think that is kind of important is the idea of a big plot twist that involves the nature of the world.
Mm.
Because at the beginning of Final Fantasy III,
that's right.
You're like living on this tiny island, and that's all there is. And then you discover that the world has been like hidden away behind. Like this mist wall or something. So all of a sudden the world becomes much bigger. And that's something you really see in Final Fantasy IV when all of a sudden you go underground. Oh, and then you're on the moon. And Final Fantasy V where you have like, you know, the void or whatever that sucks away the world and starts to change it. You have the world of light and balance and darkness and whatever in Final Fantasy VI and so forth. That's just a very integral. Yeah, kind of more or less.
Three also gave us chocobos, I think.
No, that was in
was
two,
two,
wasn't it?
Chocobos okay. were in two. Three gave us Moogle.
Moogles were in three. Okay, I thought they were in five.
They were, well, yeah. So five
they
was
started in five.
Five was like the big debut for Moogles, where they became like really part of the whole thing, and they started. I think they started saying Koopo in five, but like three, they were just in one scene. I believe.
Okay, yeah, I believe it.
So yeah, those are kind of like the big stepping stones for Final Fantasy III from which Final Fantasy IV launched itself. But Final Fantasy IV was a much bigger game, and we'll talk about that now.
A year later,
but also 8 bits later.
That's right. Oh, snap.
Yes.
It went from being on
that
NES
was kind of
to
common,
Super NES.
You know, back in the day, a lot of people like look at the Super and Famicom games, you know, these days, and they're like, can you believe this game was made in a year? And it's like, most games were made about a year.
Final Fantasy VII was made in a year.
It was really weird that The Legend of Zelda A Link to the Past took 2 years.
Right, right.
Like,
that's considered crazy.
Wasn't Mario World 2 years as well? They spent a long time on that as well?
I'm willing to give that a little bit of a benefit of a doubt because that was being developed in parallel with the hardware.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm.
But Final Fantasy IV was coming out for brand new hardware. I mean, it was really early in the Super Famicom's life and Super NES.
Mm-hmm.
It's like... Well, I guess it was like 6 months after, 6 or 7 months after the Famicom, Super Famicom launch, but just like 3 months after the Super NES launch.
Yep.
So that's pretty early. Like RPGs are big, complicated games, and they take a while to put together, and they need a certain mastery of the system and the hardware. And you would not – I mean, maybe visually you could look at Final Fantasy IV's sprites, like the character sprites on the map, and think, oh, that's a pretty early – like it's barely a step above NES. But like the music and the
music.
Systems and everything, like they're really, really intricate and really thoughtful. Like it's a huge reinvention of the Final Fantasy series that goes hand in hand with the new hardware. I mean, the idea of Super NES was like it's all the games you love but way bigger and better. And this was one that really, really embodied that.
Yeah.
It was like Final Fantasy but everything was just blown up and huge and cool looking and fast paced and whoa, what's going on?
This is the part where Sakaguchi – like he was talking a little bit about this time period in Matt Leone's Final Fantasy VII oral history.
Yeah.
He was talking about how the Squaresoft space at that time was almost like this kind of communal, like everybody's just kind of working together and throwing together their interesting ideas, not really caring too much about like sales or anything. And so Final Fantasy IV was definitely part of that kind of era. Mm. Like it was You could argue that it was kind of Square's creative peak.
They were, you know, Square was this like small company. Like it wasn't like a huge publisher. I mean, like, you know, like Enix, right, was like working with all these different outside developers and doing all these different projects. And Square was just like, you know, putting out a game or two here and there. It was privately held. You know, they were just
It was almost like a co-working space. Like anybody who wanted to come in could like totally work there. It was kind of interesting, actually.
Yeah, there's some very familiar names attached to Final Fantasy IV. Obviously, Hironobu Sakaguchi, who had kind of had the original vision for Final Fantasy. And at this point, it started to move from like director to producer role. So he was starting to be more like oversight as opposed to the lead designer on it. The more sort of hands-on people were Takashi Tokita. I don't know what he had really worked on. He worked on Final Fantasy III because he was in charge of, you know, the Final Fantasy III remake. But, you know, he was kind of like the story director. And then there was Hiroyuki Ito, who was very much the systems designer. He was like the systems designer for Final Fantasy III's job system. He was really the mind behind Final Fantasy V's massive overhaul of the job system. And then Ken Narito was the programmer. And Tetsuya Nomura helped debug the game.
That's how he got hired.
kooky, weird start for the guy.
It really is.
Because he then went on to become an artist. To become like the creative lead for Square.
They hired him as an artist. But they were like, oh, we have nothing for you to do, so debug Final Fantasy IV.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, teams are tiny. I'm sure a lot of people wore a lot of different hats.
Oh, for sure, yeah.
And he was like, you know, just starting out. So he was kind of a grunt, actually.
Mm. I mean, we probably just literally listed half the people who made this game. Right?
Probably.
I mean, it's a very small group.
Not a big team.
Right.
But they did great work, and let's talk about what the 16-bit hardware brought to Final Fantasy, because it really did feel like just a huge leap forward in a lot of ways. I mean, the visuals, like when you look at the maps and the, you know, the characters walking around dungeons, it's barely a step above Super NES or standard NES. It's not that great looking. It's nice, but tiny sprites and pretty, you know, tile-based plain backgrounds. Maybe with some like effects or some parallax scrolling. But then you get into battles and whoa, everything gets really crazy.
Yeah, the effects are a lot nicer than anything that you would have seen on the NES.
Yeah, spell effects, summons are really cool to look at.
Giant sprites, like especially Golbez.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Huge sprites. And, you know, like flying enemies had this kind of like floating effect where they were like, you know, they felt separate from the background for the first time. Also, there were backgrounds behind the characters. It wasn't just black. Fighting on a field of black,
but there
was a background that resembled the area you were in, a cave or a crazy techno tower or whatever.
Your party wasn't in another window.
Right.
You know?
And then you'd have like, you know, this kind of weird lizard bird thing floating, and it was still a static sprite, but it was kind of bobbing up and down and there was a shadow underneath it. And all of a sudden, I can kind of see the visual, like the physical space this is taking place in.
But literally,
and your character's still lined up on the right side, but they also had little shadows under them. And when you like shot an arrow, it went over from your character to the bad guy and it hit and you were like, oh, okay. Like it started to take this abstract RPG lineup and take a turn concept and give it some physical presence, which you really didn't see in RPGs before that. I can't think of any RPGs that had that aside from like
any
Ultima, where it was
RPGs.
Yeah, like Ultima had like the top down map, but that was, you know, more like a tactical view. Whereas this was like, you know, the lineup and take turns style, but almost as like a you know, a shadow box or something. Like here's a little shoebox diorama of a combat zone.
Literally the first thing you see is almost like a technical demonstration, because you see the Red Wings flying across the world map and it's kind of tilted. It's using the Mode 7, which
was
very exciting at the time.
Yeah, yep.
And then you cut to the people on the ship and then it's like, oh no, monsters are attacking. And then you get to see Cecil doing really like cool attacks to take out these monsters.
Yeah, he uses like rare items that cause spell effects to blast over them.
And
he uses abilities that for some reason don't actually exist in the game. What happened there? That's weird.
It opens with a non-interactive segment, which is the first for this series too.
Yeah. Yeah. A lengthy, you know, non-interactive segment for sure.
And on top of that, it's a direct fade in. It's like in medias res.
Yes,
you press start and it fades down and then fades up the dun, 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 dun.
Yeah, with the ships going
out. Yeah,
like
it was extremely
Star Wars. Mm-hmm. It was very different. And it's like, yeah, I mean, they had extra memory. They had extra things that they can do. And I got to say, I mean, that use of Mode 7, that very restrained use of Mode 7 in this game to, just when the airship is flying over the world, and so the world appears curved. I mean, that not only was it really smart and really, you know, they really held back. They didn't, like, you know, bombard you with Super Nintendo, you know, graphical, you know, tricks, right?
Nothing spinning at you.
That feeling of power, like whenever you get the airship in a Final Fantasy game, it's like, oh snap, I got the airship. This is the best. You feel awesome because you can fly everywhere you want.
Right.
When you get the airship in a Super Nintendo Final Fantasy game and the world literally bends underneath you.
Yeah.
Like a
the way the way it kind of tilts backward as the music kicks in.
And it visually says, I can go anywhere. Mm. Nothing can block me now. Like, that's such a great feeling.
And the fact that the game begins with you in an airship, which is something you get always late in the game as like a tool of empowerment.
Yeah.
Like, the idea here is you're, you know, like a level 8 Dark Knight. You're, you know, a high-ranking official or warrior in the kingdom. Like, this is not just a couple of kids who wander into some place they don't belong and get involved in a huge adventure. Like, you're already in the thick of things.
Yeah.
And I think a lot
you're
of this –
you're already level 10 or something like that.
Yeah. I think a lot of this has to do with Takashi Tokita, who had been a a theater major. He'd spent time with theater and thought about this in terms of staging and production and storytelling.
And this goes into Final Fantasy IV's use of RPG tropes that people understood to tell a story. Like, you start with the airship. You start with Cecil. He's already level 10. It's like, oh, okay, he's already seen some shit, you know? When you see this kind of stuff, and then you see, oh, he's a Dark Knight and Kane is a Dragoon. You know, you start to put together – and it's really important for video games of this time because – they can't spend too much time on expository sequences. They can't show you people's body language. Like, even Final Fantasy V had a whole lot of different, like, character behaviors with the field icons on the screen, you know, like hearts appearing above their heads and all that kind of stuff. Final Fantasy IV, they really couldn't do much.
You have, like, characters who look down.
Flip their hand up, right?
Or, like, they jump and spin around.
Right. Which is not even – that's not even an extra sprite.
Right.
You would jump out of bed and go, let's go.
So what they've got to – what they can do is they can let you fill in so many details about these characters simply by saying they are – they're this level. They have – they're already equipped with – when you get Palom and Porom, the twins, the kids, like they – you can see how many magic spells they've already learned. And you can see, oh, okay, well, that's how far along they are in their training. You know, it's that kind of stuff.
More to the point, when Cecil becomes a paladin, he goes back to level one.
He does. Yeah. And it's all so smart. Using the limited, you know, resources to tell that story through gameplay mechanics.
Especially
super smart.
How mechanics inform characters. I've been replaying it too. And I noticed, like, Cecil's a Dark Knight. He's super overpowered up to a certain point. And then you really need to rely on your friends who use magic.
Yeah, you get to a cave where his dark attacks are fighting against undead characters, you can't do anything. Yeah. Like, you're doing no damage to them as this powerful Dark Knight because he is a Dark Knight.
Yep.
So you have to use, like, you know, Rydia's magic spells or something. Another example is Tella. Like, he's this extremely, you know, experienced mage. He has, you know, this huge list of spells. Even though he's forgotten a lot of them, it's still like, whoa, I can't believe I've got all these spells right away.
Right.
Some of them are really powerful.
Yeah.
Like, within the first hour.
But he only has 90 magic points.
That's right.
And that's the most he'll ever have.
Because he's old.
He's old. He's lost his stamina.
Yeah.
So he can cast some of these spells, but they exhaust him very quickly. And you have to use them as a super limited resource, which is smart in terms of gameplay because you can't just, you know, spam the Octomammoth battle with, like, you know, Lightning 3 because you don't have that ability.
And it's really – it's a beautiful breakaway from this idea that an RPG must – you must level up linearly. Like, you have to – you know, you start this powerful and you end that powerful and it's a straight line.
Well, it's also a change of pace from the idea that a role-playing game is a game where you place yourself in the role that you define and create the party and the characters you want, because you don't do that in Final Fantasy IV.
No.
You're playing a role that has been prescribed for you from beginning to end. There's a little bit of freedom to wander around to do some side quests at the very end of the game.
Yeah.
But up until then, everything from the, you know, point A to point B to point C is determined. Everything along the lines of which characters you have in your party, which skills you have available for your party at a certain time, all of these things are set in stone. And you are really playing out like someone else's D&D campaign, not creating your own. So it really kind of changes up the role of the game developer as the dungeon master. Like you don't have a lot of choice in the campaign you're playing.
Yeah.
But because of that, it allows so much more flexibility.
I'm glad you hit on this. I'm not going to be here for the entire show, but I've been playing this game, like as I said, playing a lot of other Final Fantasy games, modern games. I feel like this has a very modern structure in that it's very linear. You basically go to the only next place you could possibly go. And there are maybe 3 points in the game where it's like, okay, go do side quests. But that's it. It has this really interesting structure to me that I see like Final Fantasy 15, it's just like everything is open and then it's just a narrow corridor to the end. And Final Fantasy 4, it's like narrow corridor, big space, narrow corridor, big space, narrow corridor, big space.
It's good at giving you the illusion of freedom to go places,
yeah.
But then you can really only go one place. Like at some point you have to get on a black chocobo and fly around and you're like, oh, where I can go anywhere, you know, within this world.
Yep.
But actually there's just one forest that you have to go to.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's like a few little places that are kind of off to the side where you can do a side quest or something. But again, it's really pretty fixed, pretty rigid in terms of what you can do. And you don't get to define how your characters develop. Like you don't get to put, you know, points into learning this skill or ability.
Right.
Like when your character hits this level, they're going to get that spell.
Yeah.
Yeah, Bob. I'm actually replaying it as well. You should go check it out on US Gamer Final Fantasy IV Let's Play. But it made me really, really rethink my kind of reaction to Final Fantasy XIII because when Final Fantasy XIII came out, everybody's like, oh, it's so linear and rigid and they're deciding the party for you and everything. And then you go back and you're like, oh my God, it's totally baked into the franchise's freaking DNA.
It's been a part of the franchise for a long time.
Yeah, Final Fantasy IV doesn't disagree. Give you one battle option for 3 hours though. It lets you
– Yeah.
There are
yeah.
some other issues with Final Fantasy XIII.
But I'm not
the linearity
that,
of it
I understand.
Not
necessarily
bad.
Final Fantasy IV is linear in a metaphorical sense. Final Fantasy XIII is literally a straight line that you run down.
But Final Fantasy IV, it works because – it's so fast because
yeah.
so much happens in
it's
4 hours.
You get scuttled along. But like with Final Fantasy IV, you do always have the option to like say, maybe I want to level up a little bit. Maybe I want to go try something else. You know, like there are more opportunities.
But the similarity is in the way that the encounters are specifically tuned to the way that your party is composed by
you know
the
what?
Developers.
That's the beauty
of
the design.
Totally agree with you in that.
I feel this has the cleanest design because you can grind your ass off in this game, but the developers know like you will have these members with these abilities and these will be the enemies you'll be fighting. So in every instance, they can kind of design every encounter for the party you'll have.
And I'm really looking forward to our Final Fantasy V episode because that game is the opposite of this in every possible way.
It seems
there's
like a
so
nightmare.
Many ways you can like screw yourself over.
Right.
But it's still great.
But yeah, and like grinding in Final Fantasy V is not really something that helps you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But in Final Fantasy IV, it's not something that really helps you either because the game is pretty well tuned.
The funny thing about Final Fantasy IV is that your first time through it, you're probably not – you might grind with certain party members, then they leave and they come back and you know we have to grind with other party members. But – once you realize a couple of things about Final Fantasy IV, like once you realize how the experience system works and also once you realize what your final five characters will be in your party, you can then take advantage of that. And so what people do is when you go to Mount Ordeals, you have Cecil, you have Palamporum, and Tella, right? You kill everybody except for Cecil. And then you just and then once you're the Paladin, you can wipe out everything in Mount Ordeals very easily as the Paladin. But since it's only Cecil, he gets many, many, many more experience points because he's fighting alone because you get multiple experience points. But also, at that point, Rosa, Kane, and Rydia have all been in your party. And any character that has been in your party before and comes back later, they, behind the scenes, get all of the experience that you get so that they're appropriately leveled.
Oh.
So you can get Cecil up.
I did not know that.
So you can get – I didn't know this either until I literally read about this strategy. You get Cecil up to level 45 on Mount Ordeals in like an hour or two.
Right,
you can grind him up to level 45 really fast if you do that and you kill everybody else. And then when Rosa comes back, she's level 45. When Kane comes back, he's level 45. When Rydia comes back, she's level 45.
And then Edge is a useless
and
nobody.
And then Edge is a useless nobody no matter what.
That's true.
That dude sucks.
I dislike Edge.
He is an albatross.
His name is Edge. What do you expect?
He is – I mean if not for the existence of Edward in this game, Edge would be like the worst Gomer in the history of Final Fantasy.
He does have the spoon.
He does have the spoon.
Yeah.
He does
have my life hack is not as good. I was just going to say, if you're fighting a boss, just cast Berserk on Cecil and it's like great. It works out great. Every boss fight.
Yeah. I was throwing
He's a paladin. He's supposed to be protecting the other characters.
No, you go against the teachings of the game. You cast Berserk on that guy.
My boss fight with Xeratus was literally just like, have Edge throw things until he dies. And then it's like, do I want to revive Edge so we can throw one more thing? Or do I just want to leave him dead?
Let Edge die on the moon.
Worst.
Let's talk about the combat system because it's a revolution in video game design. Even though it's a turn-based system, it's not. It's a real-time turn-based system.
Right.
How does that make any sense? My goodness, that seems like a contradiction in terms.
Well, it's turn-based, but everybody's turn is on their own clock.
Right.
Right.
And the clocks play out at real time.
Yep.
And yeah, like each character has a, you know, an agility stat, and all of a sudden that means something. It's not like I get to take X number of actions for this turn. It means I get to act again at this, you know, at this rate, at this speed.
Yeah.
And it's such a simple idea, but I'd never seen anything like that in an older game. I don't think it existed. I think this game innovated that, and it's brilliant.
It's great. That turn clock is invisible until 6, though, right?
It is.
But if you play the modern ports, you'll see that you'll see the clock.
It really threw me for a loop because I was like, wait a minute. Active time battle was totally invented for this game. Why I'm not seeing any gauges. Or,
like, 5 has a gauge.
It does?
Yeah.
Okay, I thought it was 6 that brought the gauges, but
I was like really confused for 4 a while, and then I was like, oh, no, they're totally moving. Okay, I better keep attacking them.
Yeah.
Yeah, this game has a different adaptation or interpretation of the ATB. It hadn't been refined yet. So it does, like, the turn element, you know, the time element plays into everything. So in other games, it's pretty much like you pick an action and your character will execute that action when their turn comes up. In this game, the action you take has its own time attached to it as well. So if you just pick, you know, a standard attack, you're going to move really quickly. But if you have a character like Rydia who is very slow and also casts, you know, like really powerful spells, those spells take a long time to build up. So there becomes this element of like, do I want to take the time to cast, you know, Fire 3 against this monster, or should I go, you know, more quickly and try to do something different? Should I summon here? What should I do? Mm-hmm. So it creates this entirely new strategy. The inspiration for this, according to Tokita, was F1 racing because apparently he and Ito are like super into Western sports. When I interviewed Hiroyuki Ito, like the first 15 minutes of our interview was him asking me questions about American football. And I'm like, I'm sorry, dude. I don't care about football.
Oh, man. I should have been the one doing it.
I felt like such a disappointment to him because he was like, yeah, an American journalist is talking to me. I could talk to him about the stuff that I love. And I was like, I just want to talk about RPGs.
Did he ever say Farv-sama? Okay.
Please don't. Oh, my God.
The idea behind the combat system was F1 racing, where you have, you know, every car in its track and, you know, they're going at different speeds. And, you know, if your car really sucks, then it's going to get lapped by a faster racer. So everyone's kind of moving and advancing at their own speeds. That was the concept here. Like, your turn is basically your lap around the track. So, you know, Edge, even though he's worthless, he's on a quick little car, and then Rydia is on a very, very slow car. And so this becomes a huge element in the game. And to add further to the dynamism of it, all of a sudden the attack damage that you're doing and taking displays on the battle screen, on the actual field. Mm. So you walk forward and you shake your sword, and yeah, you're like shaking your sword at midair. But then over here, there's a goblin who has little numbers that pop up, and I love the way they animate.
Yeah,
like the
it's
first
like a
number, then the yep, second. There's yep, like a, yep. a ripple, and they kind of bounce and land on the ground. And it's a very quick, subtle thing, but it's just such a great little detail. It's
yeah.
not just like a number pops up from an enemy. Most RPGs don't take the time, even now, to put that kind of loving detail into their numbers. It's just like numbers, numbers, numbers. Like modern RPGs, like Final Fantasy 13, mm-hmm. where you're like dishing out, you know, 10,000 damage at a time, like for five hits at once. It's just like the numbers mean nothing. But here, there's a visceral satisfaction to watch those little numbers pop up. And all of a sudden, you just broke four digits. Oh, my God. I am so powerful. I am so awesome. I can't believe that.
I want to think that's because the enemy sprites are usually motionless, so it's adding some sort of visual interest on the screen, you know.
There is that. Yeah. But, like, when I think of it, I always think of, like, the zoos, the big
yeah,
raven
yeah.
bird
the flying
lizard
things,
things
float. Yeah.
that float. And then the numbers pop up about that. And it's just, like, there's depth and dimension to it. And all
yeah.
of a sudden, like, again, you know, it's the shoebox diorama and everything feels so much more involving. And it's such a little thing, but the speed of the combat, the you know, the real-time element, and you can set it to be quote-unquote wait, where, you know, like it takes time, it kind of pauses the game while you're picking actions. But it's still, you know, really fast-paced, and there is this kind of tension of like, when is the enemy going to act? Am I going to act before the enemy? Like all of this just
and
comes together
move,
to create.
You see a flash, like the enemy flashes to let mm-hmm. you know that
yeah.
something is happening.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then you go, uh-oh, what's mm-hmm. going to happen? And then if it's a magic spell, you see the sign pop up and then some kind of effect. And you're like,
yeah.
hold on tight. I hope this doesn't really F up my party.
Right.
Okay, 100 damage. All right, I'm good.
Yeah.
And we should talk about the bosses because almost all of the bosses have a unique combat element to them.
Sure.
It's not just like go hit a guy really hard mm-hmm. and he's going to hit back. Like
well, again,
from the very beginning.
They try to make use of the individual special mm-hmm. powers that the characters have.
Right. Yeah. But also it just like always keeps you on your toes because you have, you know, the very first battle where, yeah, the idea is to use Kane's jump and jump in and also to learn to defend so you're not attacking the mist dragon when it's in the mist form because you'll get messed up if you do that.
Yeah.
But then you have other battles like, you know, the Calbrena, the dolls that, you know, you fight individually and then they all come together into the giant doll. That makes use of Yang's karate attack where he can hit all enemies on screen by doing the kick, the flying
right,
kick.
Right, right.
There's also another boss battle that totally utilizes Kane's jump. Oh, right, the third
Valvoline's,
fiend.
Yeah,
because she goes into the whirlwind.
You have to stop it.
You have to stop it
yep.
by using Kane. And then there's also the Mega Sisters who are like, there are three of them. The one who's going to revive them is in the back row. And so you're having to kind of bomb them with magic as much as possible. Mm-hmm. But they're using wall.
Right.
So you have to understand that you can cast wall on your own party or you can cast a spell on your own party and reflect it back to do
right.
massive damage.
Right.
And then there's combat dialogue, which is something new.
Yeah.
Yep.
During
yes.
combat, you can actually – like your characters will have conversations. In the beginning, it's just like, you know, Sissel, don't attack the mist dragon when it's in mist form or you'll get messed up.
Yeah.
But, you know, later it's the Mega Sisters – giving basically hints to say who's about to attack and who's going to reflect at you. Or you have Dr. Lugai, which is just like comedy. You're fighting
yes.
like this
yep.
this stupid little scientist and his terrible malfunctioning Frankenstein's monster.
Yeah.
And there's like comedy happening over top of the screen
right.
while you're attacking him.
And then,
or you
and
have,
then Yang dies immediately afterwards.
Right.
So a little
Pathos.
Totally weird.
Or you have Golbez who's like – you're like, oh, well, I'm completely screwed here. And then you have the big reveal of, oh, crap, Rydia's back.
Yeah.
Like you have the Mist
right.
Dragon coming and totally messing him up.
She's
and
still.
Or you have battles that happen outside of your hands, like when you finally come across Edward and Tella's like, you spoony bard, you little bastard, you stole my girl, my daughter. And like that battle happens, you don't have any control over it. It's like
right.
the characters attacking each other, and you're just like a bystander.
Cecil fighting, you know, his dark self.
Right,
and
or one of
reveals.
Arguably one of the greatest RPG moments ever, when Cecil's fighting himself in the mirror
right.
and
yeah.
becomes a paladin.
Yep, yep.
That was awesome,
it's
and
still
it still
great.
Holds up now.
It's still
or
a great moment. Yeah.
Tella again, like breaking out of the party control and, you know, going beyond his physical limits to cast Meteo. at Golbez. Golbez. Like, it's a cutscene, but it plays out as a battle, and it's really dramatic. And not on top of that, it uses game mechanics to tell the story. Like, Medio is the spell that is in Tella's inventory, and you can never cast because it doesn't have enough MP.
Yep.
So now he does cast it at the expense of his own life. Like, he kills himself to cast this spell for revenge. It's such a little thing, but it's really great storytelling through video game mechanics. And it is possible to have that sort of like subtle, nonverbal storytelling even when there's dialogue happening. Like, if you're really paying attention to what's happening in the game, you're like, oh, okay. Like, this has been set up all this time. There's like this, you know, basically Chekhov's Medio spell. And he finally used it.
Yeah. Yeah, the idea – yeah, I mean that is pretty wonderful when it's like, oh, Tella remembered Meteor. And you're like, oh, snap. And you go and look and it's like you can't use it because he doesn't have enough MP to use the spell. It's pretty good. It's
characters
pretty
like amazing. Edward who have an ability to hide. They're not natural fighters. And for some reason – so I've been reading a lot of Legends of Localization. Our friend Clyde Mandolin, he's got a great Legend of Zelda book. He's got a great Earthbound book. I believe Final Fantasy IV is going to be his next way. Book.
No.
Oh, no. Actually, no. He's done a lot of –
Mario Brothers, right?
No, he said he's not doing an RPG for a while.
Okay. Super Mario Brothers, I – think might be the next
I think
one,
it is, yeah.
But the Final Fantasy IV, the joke is that everybody wants him to do it, but it would be like 1,000 pages.
It'd be a
long.
Phone book, yeah. So if you go to legendsoflocalization.com, you can read many comparisons between different versions of the game, and it's really interesting to see that the version that every newer version is based on is actually really inaccurate, full of internet jokes. Like, I was playing the PSP version, there's a something awful joke in there, but I'm mentioning things like this because I'm leaving halfway through the show, I'm sorry, but for some reason they don't know why that Gilbert the Bard was named Edward, and he thinks it's because that's a 7 character name and there were only 6, but for some reason Edward is the one they stuck with forever. They never went back to Gilbert. I don't know why, but Gilbert's his name.
Yeah, right. Yeah. True. Yeah, but they
maybe because it's too much like Golbez.
But that's
I don't know.
But that is one of the things that stuck from Final Fantasy II in the US.
But like, please go to that website, read his work. It's really, really good, especially on this game if you care about it.
And he compares Final Fantasy IV to Final Fantasy IV Easy Type, which actually did have language differences because maybe jumping ahead a little bit, but of course they brought up Final Fantasy IV in Japan. They made it easier for the US, which we can talk about the details. But then they took that easy version, also released it in Japan as Easy Type, and it was for like kids. They took a lot of the more obscure language, like fanciful words and things like that, and they made it easier for children to read. And Clyde Mandolin talks about all of those differences. He talks about the fan translation of Final Fantasy IV. He talks about the PlayStation translation.
The DS one, yeah.
The DS, everything.
Yeah, it would be a phone book. But I'm glad you pointed that out, Chris, because I was under the assumption, a lot of other people, that the US version was Easy Type. And then much later I found out Easy Type is a distinct version that's actually even easier.
Yeah, it's based on the US version, but...
Yeah. Yes, well, the Japanese I looked in the Japanese Wikipedia page because I wanted to confirm this. And the Japanese Wikipedia page, it's Wikipedia, but it says that it was Easy Type is like it was re-imported back into Japan, even though it came out earlier.
Yeah, kind of like Final Fantasy VII International Edition, that sort of thing. Or Final Fantasy XII International Zodiac Job Edition. Like, but the international versions that they do where it's not the same as the US version, like they make big changes when they bring it back into Japan to resell it again.
Yes, and Easy Type has – they completely redid the sprite for Zeromus, and they made him look like I don't know how you describe it. Typical Final Fantasy like end boss, which is like many bodies and things glued together.
Oh, you're right.
Yeah. But that's not in any other version of the game.
It's less H.R. Giger.
Like, oh, there it is in another version of the game. If you
really,
the Final Fantasy IV Advance.
Oh yeah,
there's that bonus dungeon. Yeah. If you complete the game and find the real final ending. The final boss is Zeromus Easy Type.
Oh my god!
Yeah, so they took that sprite.
That's hilarious.
Like,
it's amazing
the work that Tosei did on the Advance games is
it's actually pretty great. Like, yeah, with Final Fantasy,
there's some problems, but they really said, let's think about what these games are about, and let's add some really interesting stuff to them.
I don't know if Tosei did the PSP one. It's an adaptation of the GBA one. The only problem I have with it is that I love the strange choices made between the designs and the sprites. Like, In the PSP version, Cecil is all white, like as he should be. But the sprite in the SNES version, I like. He's got like a yellow cape and rainbow hair. So I kind of prefer some of the choices they made in the original version that aren't retained throughout.
So the one other thing I want to talk about in terms of like the move to 16 bits is the music. And I feel like this is Chris's chance to wax eloquent.
Oh, yeah?
Because, I mean, like even without the Celtic Moon thing, I just feel like...
Oh, that's very true.
Before Chris goes and does Chris things, which we all know he's going to, and yeah. It's okay. I just want to point out that we were talking about how at the very beginning we had that technical demonstration with the airships and the map and the battle stuff. It also has one of the best themes in the entire game, which is the Red Wings theme.
Uh-huh.
And it's such a great way to open up the game because it really – like you're certainly not going to hear anything like that on the Super or the on the original NES sound chip. Like, you might go, oh, well, this looks kind of similar to an NES game, but you hear that soundtrack and you're like, oh, my God, yeah.
Well, so here's – let me set this stage.
Are you the one who added this to the notes?
I did.
Okay.
Yes.
Thanks. Because I was like, I don't remember writing this. What the hell?
Okay.
I have one thing to add before Chris because I'm only here for a limited time.
Yeah.
This time playing through, I noticed that main theme is used in many different pieces. The dun, 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 dun. You can hear that in the battle theme. You can hear that in the underworld map.
Four it's and like, five both.
Yeah. I didn't notice until this time.
The Super Nintendo sound chip, I'm sure we talked about this a million times in Retronauts, but the idea behind the Super Nintendo sound chip, which was designed by Ken Kutaragi at Sony, was that rather than simply use like FM sound and triangle waves and synth and things like that, is that every single sound in the Super Famicom would be a sample. And so it was everything was composed of audio samples, which could then be manipulated. And so that was why you got such amazing sound out of the Super Nintendo, is because if you had like more space on your cartridge, you could upload higher quality samples and the SNES could play them. So it was really like the NES, no matter what you – I mean, there were NES games that used separate sound chips and things like that. Mm-hmm. But essentially a lot of it sounded the same. But like – but the Super Famicom, you could really go nuts. The Final Fantasy IV, as they're working on Final Fantasy IV, now Dragon Quest, which of course was their main competitor, did not come out for the Super Famicom. The first version for the Super Famicom was in late 92. Yeah. So it was more than a year after Final Fantasy IV. But as they were working on Final Fantasy IV, a little game comes out by Enix called ActRaiser.
Mm.
And that game...
with music by a little guy called Yuzo Koshiro.
Who was very young at the time. He was early 20s, right? And I mean... ActRaiser was one of the first games. I got ActRaiser for my Super Nintendo before Final Fantasy II, and that was one of the games where I popped that thing into the Super Nintendo, and I was just blown. And like the voice samples that they used in some of the – I mean the music in ActRaiser made you freaking cry. Mm-hmm. It was so good. And it made Uematsu very embarrassed because – not because of the compositions – but because of the sample quality. NX had used such wonderful samples for ActRaiser, and they looked at Final Fantasy IV, and Uematsu was like, this is not nearly as good. And because of ActRaiser, they scrapped all the samples that they were using in Final Fantasy IV.
Oh, I didn't know this.
They put in higher quality samples. Hmm. And he still wasn't quite happy at the end, but, I mean, basically they – at the last minute, they were just like, our samples are not high quality enough. We need to go back in.
Yeah, and, I mean, it made a difference. Like, Final Fantasy IV, I've talked about this before. Like, going into the Mist Cave, I just, like, had to stop and turn up the music and just be like, this is, like, a movie score.
That was – so I said this when the Final Fantasy concert – the one that just happened at the San Francisco Symphony last year, when I got invited to basically interview Sakaguchi on stage, I was like, yeah, that was my I told him on stage, I was like, that was my Final Fantasy like music moment, was the Mist Cave and that piece Into the Darkness, and then of course Sakaguchi was like, I don't remember that, can you hum it? You know, we're on stage in front of a right. You know, literally the San Francisco Symphony crowd, so I had to hum it. That absolutely the same thing happened to me. And it was a combination of the beauty of that piece of music, but then also the transparency effects of the Super NES, which had the mist floating over the dungeon.
Yeah.
And that was the first time I'd seen something
sound and vision
just
together.
Everything. And they matched each other aesthetically so well. And also, that piece of music does not sound like dungeon music, you know? Like, you expect dungeon music to be you know? But instead, it's this,
like, Uematsu always had, like, upbeat dungeon music.
Yeah.
Like the Golg Volcano kind of music.
Right, but this is like a freaking string quartet in my bedroom, you know, playing with this. That was just unbelievable. And so, yeah, Uematsu, yes, once they finished Final Fantasy IV, decided for whatever reason that the album, he was going to have to fly to Ireland and assemble a crew of people who were actually very well known in the Irish music scene at that time to record this album. And it's Celtic Moon is interesting because you can kind of hear that, like, I get the sense a lot of them are kind of sight reading. You know what I mean? There's not a lot of verve in Celtic Moon. I think they were doing a job and did it, you know, got their money for a couple of days and left. But like that album, I mean, that was one of the first Final Fantasy albums that I bought, and that was just incredible.
Yeah, it's so different from what you expect. Like that and Chrono Trigger Brink of Time. You're just like, what's happening here?
Because the previous Final – I mean, there were two previous Final Fantasy arranged albums, and the one of them was the live concert, which makes sense. And then the next one was the Final Fantasy III album with the weird English voice narration in the middle of it. But all of those arrangements were very straightforward, studio synthesized, you know, just high quality arrangements of the songs. But Celtic Moon – takes the Final Fantasy IV soundtrack, gives the whole thing an artistic, you know, like...
Patina,
thank you. But then also, I mean, it connects all of the music together because all the arrangements are so similar.
Right. Yeah. And that's something that's worth mentioning is that there's so much diversity in the soundtrack. I mean, this is Nobuo Uematsu at his prog rock best. He's like pulling the full palette here. You know, you have the symphonic quality of Into the Darkness, but then the boss battles are just like these intense, heavy prog rock style arrangements with like some strings, but also, you know, bass guitar and big drums, timpanis, bum, bum, bum.
Especially the Four Fiends song.
Yes.
Where there's
God.
There's like a little section of this music that's like triumphant before it gets back into like terrifying. Predicting the flow of battle, I think.
Yep. I want to make a couple observations.
Sure,
first, Final Fantasy IV has my favorite boss battle theme in the series, mostly because, I mean, it's not overly complicated, but it always gets me really into the mood of the actual battle. And even though it like loops back and kind of starts over, it's fine because like you're so focused on the battle and it's like that perfect background theme.
I think it starts off with the same bass line as the regular battle music,
but
right?
But then it goes,
misleads you. Yeah.
But it starts
off.
No,
it's worse.
Yeah.
But when it starts, it's kind of an octave up from the normal, like, rando battle music. And then it's, like, faster. And then it starts in on the actual anthem. And you're like, all right, this is it. Like, yeah. I'm in a big fight now. And
that's then a great boss theme.
The greatness of the Four Fiends battle theme, of course, is the first time you encounter the Four Fiends, which is one of my favorite moments in the game.
Yeah.
It's like you're fighting, you know, this guy who's like, oh, that wasn't so hard. Like, I fought some zombies.
Right,
I killed them.
Yeah,
regular boss battle theme. You're like, you're fine. And then, the Four Fiend theme starts.
Back attack.
Yeah.
And you're not prepped. And maybe you didn't heal because you were like, oh, I'm done
done with that. That's fine.
And then, it's a different theme. Yeah.
So great.
For sure.
The other observation I wanted to make was that it was – for 1991, it was really like a film score. Like one really great example is like Palam and Purim when they make their big heroic sacrifice and they're turned to stone. Like it starts off with like really intense music as like the walls are coming in. And you're like, oh, like tons of tension and everything. But then they turn to stone and you get to this really like subdued kind of like a single note – kind of playing.
They're playing that main theme, but like a somber version of it.
Yes. Yeah. And you're just kind of like, oh. And like we kind of can goof on Final Fantasy IV so much for relying so heavily on heroic sacrifices throughout.
Yeah.
But it made each one kind of have a lot of punch and the score had a lot to do with it.
You're right, Kat. I mean, it does score music to the action, which was kind of rare at the time. If I had ever seen it before, I don't remember. But it was like scoring appropriately. It wasn't like, here's the scene, here's a song for the scene. Like things were changing as the scene changed.
I mean, think about the games that came out at the time. Like Super Mario World comes out. I mean, it had really great music. But, you know, you're like – you're bopping along to certain music for each level, whatever.
Yeah.
Like this is dynamically changing within the battles. Like you're fighting Golbez and it's playing a certain theme and then Rydia comes in and the music totally changes and you're like, all right, Four Fiends theme, time to go. All right.
Yeah.
Like it does such a great job of manipulating like how you're supposed to be feeling at any given moment.
By setting you up for this is what this music means, to bring that music back in, it immediately has that emotion.
And it would also bring like a sense of dread. You'd be like the screen would kind of turn purple and the music would change. You go, oh, crap. Now what's going to come at me? Did I save? Am I like healed up? Oh, no.
Right.
And, you know, the what you said, Bob, about the kind of the leitmotif of the main theme being used throughout the game – like that evokes so many different moods, not just, you know, like the sort of solemn, oh no, Palam and Purim. But then you get to the moon and it's taking those notes and turning them into like this echoey, dissonant, almost atonal, like boop, 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 boop.
Yeah, and then it brings
It's you're like, whoa, I'm way out of my depth here. Like, what is happening?
Yeah, I like how I'm not in Kansas anymore. And then the strings come up, and it's just like, well, it's a little bit of familiarity. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
yeah, just a great, great soundtrack. I mean, it's one of those memorable moments in the movie Scott Pilgrim versus the World, where he just like brings out his bass guitar and he just kind of goofs around and plays like the introductory riff to the the Final Fantasy IV battle scene.
Play the Final Fantasy II. Yeah,
like.
Music, yeah.
Okay, like that's kind of a deep cut for most people, but it really does speak to, you know, for certain people, like whoever wrote that, that music, that soundtrack made an impact. It had it left an impression.
Maybe Maybe it's just because I played this game so much in its original form, but I always turn on the original music in the PSP version or whatever version I'm playing, or I wish it was the original music, because even if the samples are better or it's more technologically sound or whatever, I still love how that Super Nintendo sounds, because nothing sounds like it. Mm-hmm. And all my memories are associated with those instruments in that way.
Yeah, and that was one of the things they brought back for, you know, with Final Fantasy IX, which was that first attempt to like, oh, you know, sorry we got off on this crazy path with the Final Fantasy games. We're going to do something that really feels like the Super Nintendo games again. One of the major things that they, you know, brought back alongside, like, Moogles and, you know, Black Mages was as soon as you got into a battle, you heard da-da-da-da-da.
Yeah.
And then they just kept doing it for the entire battle. Like, that was the stage.
Just because the load times were really bad.
Yeah.
So I'm going to make it.
Oh, yeah.
So I'm going to make an admission, and that's that I didn't play Final Fantasy IV until, like, 2000. And so it was pretty late. Okay. It had been out for
what
a long time.
What did you play it on?
Super Nintendo.
Oh, so you played the American Super Nintendo.
Yeah, I played
version.
Final Fantasy II. Somebody loaned it to me. At that time, like, Final Fantasy games, they were still really quite expensive and kind of hard to find. Like, you could maybe find them at your local Funko Land.
They were
or
never cheap.
But I was kind of getting into it, and Final Fantasy VI was the first one that I played. I went back to Final Fantasy IV, and I was like, oh, wow, this is like a way huge step down from Final Fantasy VI. This almost looks like an NES game.
Yeah.
But then that soundtrack kicked in, and I was like, all right, I can go with this.
Okay, all right, Final Fantasy II.
I played Final Fantasy IV or II in 1992 when it was still pretty new, but I didn't beat it until 1999. I rented it, and for like 3 days, I got to the very end and I lost against Zeromus or Zemus or whatever, and then I had to take the game back. And
I beat
was like,
it.
I'm never going to finish this game. Oh well. But then later, I was like, I can do this.
I actually got into RPGs through Final Fantasy II/IV in that I would tinker with them in the past, but they were too complex for me. Well, when this game came out, my stepdad is a huge nerd, and he was playing video games like this at the time. And I basically – he'd come from home from work every day, and I'd watch him play through a little more of this game. And I was, like, obsessed with the story, all the cliffhangers. I mean, it's a really childish storybook story, but if you're 9, it's like, oh, my God, people are dying, and what's going to happen next? But watching him play through the entire game gave me the confidence to do it myself, and from then on, I could play RPGs. So this has really set me down the path of being a horrible nerd. Really.
And they did. I mean, you know, for as much as it's like, oh, yeah, you know, Squaresoft. Back in the day, they thought Americans were stupid and, you know, couldn't play RPGs. It's like, well, I mean, I did really get into Final Fantasy II when I was, you know, young. And so clearly, you know, they dumbing the game down, you know, and making it easier for us. Like, it probably did actually get some people into
that was
the
fine.
Genre.
Mystic Quest, not so much.
No.
And on that note, I think we'll take a break. And Bob, I guess this is where we say goodbye.
That's me. I'm sorry, everybody. I have other obligations, but I love you all. And
thanks for stopping in.
Where
can we
find
you on the internet?
Oh, Bob Server on Twitter. My other podcast is Talking Simpsons, TalkingSimpsons.com. Every day, every week. Sorry, every week it's a new episode of The Simpsons. We talk about it. Look for it in your podcast machine. Goodbye, everybody.
All right. We'll be right back. And we're back. Hi, everyone. It's the second half of this episode. Probably more like the second one-third of it. I don't know. Like, I don't think the second portion is going to be as long. I'm not good at numbers. I studied graphic design. Don't ask me.
Let's see what happens.
Math. All right. So something that I had talked about earlier was the way Final Fantasy III or Final Fantasy IV takes the job system of Final Fantasy III and applies it to a fixed cast. We talked about kind of how that breaks down in terms of like the game flow and the sort of predetermined, you know, party makeup for each battle. So it can be very like boutique combat, like every battle is custom tailored to your party makeup. But I think it's interesting to look at sort of the jobs that came over from Final Fantasy III and what they applied to, like where they kind of landed on the characters. It's also interesting that there were a couple of jobs that didn't show up in any real sense that I can think of.
But it's only a couple.
Only a couple. Geomancer and Viking.
Yeah.
Like Geomancer, you know, is about using like the environment, the current environment to use special effects and cast magic. It's a very situational skill and very difficult to use.
And that didn't really show up even at all. Although
Final Fantasy V has it.
In Final Fantasy IV, like, it didn't even show up non-playable character or any kind of situation.
Yeah, but, I mean, you still see, like, red mages and stuff in Final Fantasy IV, but not...
But the Vikings look a lot like the dwarves in Final Fantasy IV.
Yeah, that's true.
They have dark faces and glowy eyes and pointy
hats. They look kind of like black mages.
And they make axes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yep. So...
But Vikings, the actual skill in Final Fantasy III was basically to draw aggro from enemies. Like, that was kind of your main purpose. And Cecil kind of does that as a paladin, but instead of drawing aggro, he can cover enemies.
Yeah.
Which is not quite the same thing, or cover allies.
Yes.
Which is not quite the same thing, because basically you turn on cover and then you block attacks from other enemies. With the Viking – enemies don't always attack you. It just like increases the appeal of your character as a target.
But
so it's a little different.
Cecil will do you don't have to turn on cover because he will cover characters that are
critical
near death.
Critical character he'll always cover, but you can choose to turn on cover anytime. Mm-hmm. And that's taken directly from the knight class in Final Fantasy III. Mm-hmm. Even though it's called paladin here, it's a knight.
Gotcha.
But he starts out as a Dark Knight, which is actually more of a prestige class in Final Fantasy III. It's like a later skill that you get. Mm-hmm. And the idea in Final Fantasy III, if I'm remembering right, is that you basically have special dark element attacks that you use like a tenth of your hit points to cast. And that's what Cecil does. Something they took away in Final Fantasy II.
Yeah. Because they took – with Final Fantasy II and the dumbification of Final Fantasy IV, they basically – I mean they made a lot of changes, mm-hmm. right? A lot of changes. Final Fantasy – they took out like half the items, right?
Because they gave you like Remedy as the cure-all, the panacea basically.
Right, and it was super cheap. And
it was Heal.
It was called Heal, and it healed everything.
But you had Cure and Heal, and you're like, this is not – this is confusing.
Right. But in the Japanese version, you had
– it's kind of reversed because you heal a wound. A wound heals, and you cure an illness.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, whoops.
But yeah, in the Japanese version, you had different items for each status element. You had, Gold Needle for Stone. You had Maiden's Kiss for Frog. Mm-hmm. You had was it just a cure potion or
Echo Screen?
And then whatever for antidote for poison.
Everything for everything.
Yeah.
And there were a whole bunch of different status effects.
Yeah.
They all had their own thing. And it made item management really difficult because you had a very limited inventory and you could only carry, I believe, 48 unique items.
Right.
And you can carry 99 of those items, right?
But,
So, of course, it made item management they had the fat chocobo. And
yeah, especially once you get Rosa in your party and she's an archer and she has different kinds of arrows. And, maybe you need an ice arrow to go up against the fire enemies, but you don't want to have ice arrows equipped when an ice enemy shows up.
Yep.
So, yeah, it becomes like an inventory juggling situation.
You do have to – it's almost Earthbound-esque as far as having to really, really manage your inventory for sure.
A couple observations on just the abilities that got changed. Mm-hmm. First
– oh, you didn't even get to that.
When
yet.
You take out the – when you take out the fact that they took out the Dark Knight's ability, the Dark Wave ability.
Yeah.
That still shows up actually when you're fighting.
It does
the
mirror intro. That's right.
The mirror version does it.
Which I'm going, what the heck is that?
Why is he doing this? Yeah, exactly. That's his ability. But it's like if I'm fighting myself, why is he doing this thing that I can't do?
The other thing is that
it makes sense in the mirror battle that the Dark Knight would eventually defeat itself.
Yeah.
By using its hit points to cast Dark Wave.
Right.
But you don't know that in the American version because you don't have the ability to do that as a Dark Knight.
Well, the American version, right. So they take out half the items and they sort of like reduce it down to like heal, right? And they take out all the attack items because there's attack items that can do thunder, but then also thunder-ah. There's an attack item that can do that too. There's tons of them. There's an attack item that can cause death. They took out any item that wasn't necessary, and they took out any ability that was not necessary to complete battle. So, Kane still has jump, but man, I gotta tell you, I almost feel like if Jump wasn't like an important part of the Valvolous fight, they would have taken that right out too.
Probably.
And they would have just made you fight with Kane's, and you would have been like, what's a Dragoon? It's a knight that fights with
a Sid lance. Keeps his peep ability.
That's
true, yeah.
Yeah.
So you can still scan enemies. Rosa loses prayer.
She does.
Which is actually kind
of
annoying.
Because of her religious thing.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, but they could have just retitled that something.
They could have.
But well, yeah. It's kind of annoying because you lose cheap heal. And
you do, yeah.
She's actually not great without it.
No.
Yeah.
No. Not in the early part of the game, certainly.
No.
It's been a long time since I played Final Fantasy II.
Yeah.
I can't remember what else was lost.
Tella has Remember.
Okay.
They took that out.
Okay.
Yep.
And remember, it's worth explaining what that is.
Remember is Tella, because when he starts out with only a few of his spells, he can use Remember, and then he can randomly use one of the spells that he had forgotten. And so, like, you actually – I mean, you can remember, like –
something crazy, like,
a water enemy or something like that. It's accidentally, but it's very –
unlikely.
It's unlikely. Sometimes he can't remember anything, and it's a waste of a turn in that case. Sometimes he remembers a fire spell and uses it on a fire enemy, and it heals them, you know?
Yeah, it almost feels like that was kind of inspired by the goof-off in Dragon Quest III, where you have a random ability, and maybe it's going to be awesome, but maybe it's not.
Yep.
They also took out Shell and Protect.
They did.
Which are actually fairly important because, obviously, they can help.
Yeah, but also – In doing that, they made the game easier also.
Right, yeah.
So, I mean,
so
you
it's
didn't
not
actually
a big deal.
Need to use Protect and Shell. But yeah, but they basically just wanted to make it as simple as possible for you to get through the game.
Right. So you have Cecil, who is the Paladin and Dark Knight, or reverse of that, Dark Knight, and then Paladin, which is a knight. Rosa is there an archer class in Final Fantasy III? I can't remember. Is that like Ranger?
It's in 5, but I don't know if it's in 3.
I'm trying to remember. I should have looked that up. But she's a white mage, but her attack ability is she can use staves, but she can also use bows, which is actually pretty unusual. Like, I can't think of any other white mage characters who have that option. And it's actually it makes her somewhat more useful in battle. Like, when you're going dink, with a little staff.
Well, especially because
who cares?
You can use the arrows to attack while you're in the back row, and it doesn't have the damage.
Yeah, so that's nice. Kane, of course, is a dragon knight or dragoon, which basically means he can jump, and that takes him out of battle for a little while. He's no longer a targetable character, which can be really helpful if an enemy has targeted him. Because does it work like that? Do enemy turns take time to play out like a
– No, it's
I don't think
well,
they do.
The thing is it's a risk-reward thing. So, no, the enemy doesn't target you first. They just they target whoever's on the battlefield.
Right.
So if Kane jumps, that means that if you have lower defense characters that are down there, it means they might take the damage that Kane might have absorbed.
And it also tends to take him out of battle for a while because the execution time on jumping is much longer than
a standard
attack.
You lose having a tank down there absorbing damage.
Right.
Yeah. But – when you're fighting Golbez, you want to jump because he will take out a good chunk of your party.
He'll take out the whole party
except for Cecil.
Will have one HP.
But if Kane's in the air,
he doesn't get him.
He doesn't get him.
He comes back down with full HP. Yeah, I think every time I've won that battle, it's because I got to jump off with Kane before he did that attack for sure. Yeah. I played the PSP version of this game in preparation for this podcast, and I had never actually played that version before. And it's already a lot faster to kind of run through that game, but what I did not realize until much later is that there's an auto battle setting for the PSP version. I don't know if they have it in the Game Boy version, but man.
No.
PSP version, there's an auto battle. You press select in battle. And if you have – you know how you can change the cursor mode in Final Fantasy games to either just always be on fight or be on whatever you left it on? If you just set the cursors to what you want characters to do and then just press select, they will start auto-battling, but it's twice the speed of the battles.
Hmm.
So these battles are already a lot faster in the PSP version if you want to increase the speed. But the auto battle, it's so quick. And so for leveling up, I was just using auto battle and it went so fast. And then one of the other level up tricks is when you go to the land of summon monsters, where Rydia, where you fight like Leviathan and Ashura, there is a summoner enemy that summons more monsters, right, into the battle with them. If you get to the point where – and, of course, I read about doing this. And I'm like, okay, I really got to try this. There's a summoner that summons Arachne, which is Spider Lady. And all Arachne does is Earthquake. So you cast Float to everybody so nothing can hit you. And then I went in. I had Cecil at the Ice Brand, which killed Arachne in one hit at that point. And I turned on – I had everybody else defend. And I turned on Auto Battle. And it was perfectly timed so that the summoner would summon Arachne, Cecil would kill Arachne, and then in the time it took for Cecil to take another turn, summoner would bring out another Arachne because the summoner only summons the same enemy. So literally, if you watch this a battle like this taking place, it was like, dead, dead, dead. And it was like 5,000 experience, 5,000 experience. I left it, and I was on the plane to the Switch event. I put it on my tray table, and I just watched it run for like 15 minutes. Then after like 15 minutes of this, I stopped it, and I went up 7 levels. I went from level 45 to 51.
Jeez.
It was insane. It was completely insane.
Kohler's OP.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. The downside to that is that you have to press the select button on the PSP, which is one of the worst button designs ever.
So I use the Vita.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. That's not as bad.
No.
It's the best thing you can play Final Fantasy IV Complete Collection on the Vita or on the PSTV.
Yeah. That's right. That's
yeah,
true.
How does
it,
best way
you
to play it
on PSTV?
I have not, but I know you can do it.
I bet it looks pretty good.
I bet it does.
Probably so. I know PS1 games look pretty nice on PSTV. I've only ever used my PSTV to play Parasite Eve, but it looked nice. It was like, oh, really crisp, clean Parasite Eve. Hooray.
Interesting.
Anyway, so yeah, going back through the characters, Rydia is actually the most diverse character because she is a black mage and she starts out as an evoker, which is basically like a low-level summoner, and then she disappears and she comes back and she's like a total – actually, she's just an evoker at first. No, she can cast magic.
She
but she's
can
like
black magic,
greatly,
white magic, yeah. And summons it first.
Oh, that's right. And then she loses the ability to do white magic.
That's right.
She comes back as a summoner slash black mage, but she starts out as a red mage slash evoker.
Yeah, yeah.
I want to point out,
diverse.
By the way, we were talking earlier about how mechanics used to express storytelling. Early on, Rydia can't use fire. For obvious reasons.
That's right.
And then there's the big moment when they finally get her to use fire.
We can say the spoiler.
It's okay. It's early in the game. It's fine.
I mean, we just spoiled a heck of a lot.
We spoiled everything about this game.
We spoiled Yang dying.
This game came out in 1991.
Yang doesn't really die. Oh, I spoiled that too.
Well, this is a deep dive. There's going to be spoilers.
Yeah.
Sorry.
But anyway, Cecil at the beginning of the game and Kane unwittingly destroy Rydia's village with fire. And she's like, I hate fire. You killed my mom with fire, so I don't want to use the fire spell.
I mean, yeah, in the first, like...
And you notice in her inventory, she doesn't have fire in there.
Nope.
It's kind of like, it's kind of weird. Yeah.
But there's a big moment where she has to use fire, and she gets up the courage to do so. And then it says, Rydia learned fire. Yay!
And then she becomes evil and forgets how to do white magic.
She doesn't become evil.
I'm kidding.
A little.
A little evil.
Leviathan,
yeah.
I'm replaying it on the SNES, as I may have mentioned.
You mean Leviathan?
So the localization is just incredible. Like when you go and meet the dwarves and they're like – you know, they're like rally ho, but they're like Lally. And I'm like Lally.
Right.
Oh,
yeah.
Rally, of course.
Of course.
On and on.
And that was another thing, you know, that stuck essentially.
There's also
– the series.
I'm coming down from the Mount Ordeals. And I'm like the Mount Ordeals. Okay.
Right. Not ordeals.
Yes, but many,
I
many.
My favorite is dwarf armors are hard. Can you move in it?
they tried, by God.
We mean
like some
Japanese
person
with an English dictionary tried. And you know what?
But they came up with Spoonie.
That person
That's
did
memorable.
Try. They tried.
They did.
Yeah.
They did a pretty good job and it needed a second pass.
Yep. Yep.
But as a starting localization, it's fine. Mm-hmm. It's just it wasn't finished.
Yeah.
But
it needed, it needed a native English speaker to look at it and say, nope, that's stupid.
And would never Square say that. Would hire native English speakers to do localizations in the future.
Yeah, starting with literally Secret of Mana. Right after Final Fantasy II. Yeah.
This was back in the day when they still said Fire 1, Fire 2.
They did, yeah.
Lit
and
1,
at the
lit
time,
2.
Actually, and when they changed it for Final Fantasy VIII to like Faraga and all that, I was actually annoyed because I'm like, well, Fire 3, I mean, it's so self-explanatory, like very powerful. But now I'm like, oh, yeah, Fire, oh, man, that's really basic. Okay.
Yeah. And this one goes up to like Faraja?
It goes up to Ja.
Ja?
It
does. Yeah.
Yeah.
It doesn't go up to Faraja. It goes up to Curaja, but that's it.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Or Cure 4.
Cure 4. Mm. And that's something they brought to Easy Type as well. They've renamed the spells. So Faya 1. Faya 2.
Anyway, so yeah, under the characters, Yang, you have basically straight black belt. Edge is a ninja and a thief because he has the Steel Command, right?
But also useless.
Yes.
But also useless.
But the Steel Command can be helpful sometimes, maybe, if you're a cheapskate.
Do you feel like Shadow was like an attempt to make amends for Edge by making Shadow like such a badass?
No, that was designed by – he was designed by Nomura.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's just Nomura working in Nomura mode.
Yeah.
Let's make him badass.
Yep.
But he had a dog, and he was awesome.
He did have a dog.
So the game has two sages, which I think is interesting. Tella dies off, and he is definitely a sage, which is like the prestige class mage who can do anything.
Yep.
And then later you get Fuso Ya, who is in the party a very brief amount of time.
Yes. What was the deal with that dude?
Like, it's weird.
So like why?
Like when he dies, he melts or something?
It was because Kane.
Kane disappears for a little while. Yeah.
Yeah, and then Fuso Ya joins for a little while, then Kane. Comes back.
And then they, like, Kane or Fuso Ya and Golbez go off to find the moon or something.
I don't know why they bothered putting Fuso Ya in the party. Like, it doesn't make any sense.
I don't know. He's just there for a little while and you're like, oh, I've got this guy who melts.
Yeah, he does melt. He does.
Getting back to Tella really quickly.
Oh, yeah.
So, by, like, modern kind of gaming vocabulary, you would think, oh, he's totally a tutorial character. And he does function in that regard early on because he's, like, super powerful. Mm-hmm. Like, he can nuke a lot of enemies. You're like, great. And then he comes back much later and
he's a liability.
But no, when he learns all those spells, he's actually still quite strong. I mean, yeah, like, you have to manage his MP and everything. But it's actually really kind of interesting that they had this almost tutorial-like character, but then that he is in for such a large chunk of the game.
Right. But he becomes a liability in another sense because his physical stats don't really improve. In fact, he can sometimes lose hit points when he levels up. Like that's
he's dying. He's dying slowly.
He is. It's terrible. Like he becomes weaker as he levels up sometimes.
There's actually an equivalent in Fire Emblem.
And he never gains more hit points or magic points ever. Yeah.
There's actually an equivalent in Fire Emblem. It's the Jagan, which is you have this character who's like a prestige class. He's like a top knight or whatever. And in the original game, he was Jagan. And you can use him a lot, but you got to be careful because he's strong in the early going, but he doesn't like improve at all. Mm. He actually and pretty quickly eventually just gets passed by everybody. And if you use him as an endgame unit, you're in trouble. Mm. It's like a trap. It's a trap. Sure. But in Final Fantasy IV, it doesn't matter because like it controls your party for you.
Yeah, because also Tella dies. And he's the only – Tella is the only one of your playable characters who actually dies. But
everyone else dies for a little while, right, and then they come back.
But they actually do. I mean, but is it any less impactful at that moment? It's not. It's like when Palom and Porom turn themselves to stone.
That's heartbreaking.
It is heartbreaking.
And when you think that they're twerp.
When
can't you
Yang
go back
sacrifices
to them?
Himself, yeah. Or when Yang sacrifices himself, then when Cid sacrifices himself, like it's all like, oh my God.
Yeah,
like,
but then Cid comes back like 5 minutes later.
He does.
Like, like that's the point at which you're like, well, okay.
Yeah.
But when Tella dies, his body disappears.
Yes.
So that you don't have to deal with the fact that they just go, well, he's dead. And then they just leave him to rot on the floor of the Tower of Zot.
And I love that in with Palom and Porom, when you click on them, it opens up your little item dialog box and you can use a golden needle on them. Mm-hmm. And it says that doesn't work because they turn themselves to stone of their own volition. Mm-hmm. And, of course, in Final Fantasy II, where there is no golden needle, you can click on them to do nothing. Like you can bring up your item box and then there's nothing
It's like,
you can
what's
do.
Happening?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
Oh, well. Yeah, so some of the other characters, the last few characters, a little more obscure. Like, I guess Cid would be a scholar. There was no engineer class in Final Fantasy III, but okay. Scholars could, like, see enemy attacks. But they also, like, attacked with books. So it's not
smarter.
It's not
smarter to make him like a working man, you know, and but make him an engineer,
right?
Yeah,
but he like throws wrenches at bad guys, or no, he just hits him.
Hits
with a wrench.
Him. He whacks him with a wrench.
Yeah. Shit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And hammers too. Hammers and wrenches.
I always had him equipped with hammers.
Okay.
I just gave him a silver wrench.
Maybe I'm thinking of.
I gave him a silver wrench.
Oh.
Okay. Yeah. I was thinking that's right. I was like, maybe I'm getting mistaken for Monty Mole.
I think that the icon for the hammer looks like a wrench.
Okay, well, I was confused. I'm like, okay. Oh, that must be a wrench.
It does look like a wrench.
Because it just says – it has a thing. It says silver.
Yeah.
I think that's a hammer.
Probably.
But I don't – yeah.
Did he steal it from Maxwell?
Yes.
Oh, wow.
Also, everything that was quote-unquote silver in Final Fantasy II was Mithril.
Yeah.
And another thing they changed because they were like, American kids won't know what Mithril is.
Mithril? No one's ever read Lord of the Rings in America.
Right.
Yeah. And then finally, Palom and Porom are a Devout and a Magus, which are character classes that I think got bumped out of the remake of Final Fantasy III, didn't they? Just like
I think so.
Wiped out.
Yep.
They're like the lower level mage classes.
Yep.
So each of them can only cast a school of magic, white or black magic, right. Which I guess in any other game would be white mage, black mage. But Final Fantasy III called them Devout and Magus.
Which one is the girl?
I can never remember.
I literally just replayed this game. Porom,
I think, is
the
girl.
The girl.
Yeah.
And she had cry.
Right.
She could cry.
And what did Palom have? It was like boast or something?
I think so.
Yeah.
But in the SNES version, there's also a twin.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, there is a twin.
And
the
that's
twin
in
cast.
Final Fantasy II as well.
How does twin cast work?
They both start casting.
Yeah,
spells.
Yeah.
And
but if one of them gets killed, then oops.
But sometimes they would say, the first time I got a really powerful spell on it, I'm like, oh, sweet. But this after that, it was just like nothing happened.
It's random.
Oh.
It's kind of like remember.
Kind of annoying and not worth it.
So like sometimes it's something okay, and then sometimes it's like it's Comet, which is like baby meteor.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I think that's about all I have to say about Final Fantasy IV itself. Is there more that needs to be discussed, do you think?
Well, I mean, we could spend a lot of time on Final Fantasy IV, but nothing that's jumping to mind?
It was a – I mean, I think people forget like what a – how it really set the stage for JRPGs to come in terms of the way that its story tropes, how
much
it handled –
more focus on – story.
Yeah. I would say that was a turning point at which JRPGs stopped trying to be like Dragon Quest and suddenly started trying to be like this other game.
The JRPG that we know, like the that people kind of goof on, that is Final Fantasy IV.
Yeah, yeah, yep.
But the funny thing is you look back on it and people are like, oh, well, Final Fantasy IV, you know, we kind of goof on it. It's like cheesy and everything. But it really holds up. I've been replaying it. First of all, man, that game moves at such a clip. Like within like 5 hours, so much has happened, but it doesn't feel rushed. Like I feel like it does such an expert job of establishing these relationships really quickly, like keeping the plot moving so you're never really getting bored. But at the same time, like it all feels really natural. So like when you meet Palom and Porom and like in less than an hour later, they're turning into, you know, statues. And you feel like heartbroken. You feel like you've been with them forever, stuff like that.
It's a really lean video game. There's no fat in terms of the story or in terms of the gameplay. Mm-hmm. Like you can blast through this game in 12 hours.
Although I have to say, I mean, you know, might this game have been better had they had this game been like a 50-hour game instead of a 30-hour game? Had they put more dungeons in to let you spend more time with those characters and not cycle them out in and out so fast? No.
I like a good 20-hour RPG.
Think, I think its briskness works in its favor.
There's not a whole lot of 20-hour RPGs. Yeah. I mean, potentially, yeah.
I mean, Suikoden is a 20-hour RPG, and it gives you 108 characters to play with.
Yeah.
I mean, among other things, like we were talking about how wonderfully balanced and how interesting each of the boss battles are, and there's a lot of them. Like when you're going through a lot of the dungeons, you're probably going to fight a minimum of at least two bosses, and they're treated as like, you know, legit bosses. Like, and it's almost like a puzzle, and like figuring out. It's like, okay, well, I got this party mix, and I need to figure out like what exactly I'm supposed to be doing with them. And in the SNES version, not so hard, right? Like, I've been like kind of going, oh, well, this is actually surprisingly easy. I already killed you. Okay. Whereas, like, once you get to the PSP version, like the remake, it's like it starts, you know, kind of kicking up the difficulty just a little bit. Yeah. And then, of course, once you get to the moon, the game's like, oh, you're going to kick your ass now.
Yeah.
Another thing that I remember, like, when I went back to Final Fantasy II back in, like, 2000 or whatever, after playing 6, my first thought was, oh, this is really, like, fantasy. Okay, this is, like, much more fantasy, like, medieval.
Right.
But then you get a hovercraft. And yeah. And then by the end, you're on a space whale.
You're fighting through a giant robot.
Right.
Yeah, you're fighting through a giant robot, and the Tower of Zod is, like, really technological.
Yeah.
And, like, so much of what I associate with Final Fantasy, like, really was codified in Final Fantasy IV.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, Final Fantasy, I mean, ever since Final Fantasy I and running into Warmech, you know, has been about, like,
Final Fantasy had time travel, was, for God's sake.
Right. It was medieval fantasy with a little injection of sci-fi. Mm-hmm. Like, that was always there. And, of course, I mean, geez, the first Ultima game, I mean, you get in a spaceship, right?
So, Ultima 2 has, like, a shooter section.
Yeah. So, yeah. I mean, that's always been kind of a part of, like, the computer RPG in general been – has just had that little sci-fi twist to it because it was the Wild West and you can do whatever you want.
Right.
But, yeah.
Yeah, I think Final Fantasy IV works as a brief game. I think there is a tendency among video game fans to say, oh, I like this. I wish there were more of it. And that's precisely the attitude that got us Final Fantasy IV, the after years, which I don't think anyone really wanted. We asked for it and then we regretted it.
I didn't. I never asked for this.
Do we even want to talk about this game?
Well, I mean, let's talk about the sort of the ports of Final Fantasy IV to get
yes,
up to that.
Let's talk about the ports.
Yeah, so there are a lot of distinct versions of this game, maybe more so than any other RPG I can think of.
Oh, there's a lot.
Yeah, because, you know, you have the Super Famicom release, the American Super NES release, which is a substantially different game in terms of balance and content.
And then Easy Type.
And then Easy Type, which has also changed.
Yep.
And then a few years later, you had the PlayStation version, which basically took Final Fantasy IV, the Japanese game.
Mm-hmm. And added load times.
Yeah, also.
But it's not too bad. Like, this
not
wasn't,
as bad
this
as
one wasn't
five.
As bad. Five and six, especially.
Yeah.
Six was really bad.
No, four was the worst of those three.
Was it?
Really?
Especially in the original PlayStation version, the load times and the time it took to save your game were absolutely. So that's why I think they put the memo.
Oh, you know, maybe
save
I. Okay.
They cleaned it up for the U.S. version. When they finally brought out Final Fantasy IV for the PlayStation in the U.S., they actually went back and they fixed a lot of the load times.
Okay.
The original Japanese version, which I did actually play a big chunk of, saving your game took so long, they actually created little Pac-Man-style sequences where the characters would come out and run around with each other that you could watch while the game was saving. I'm pretty sure I'm not making that up.
Well, and that came out in the U.S. in Final Fantasy Chronicles, right?
Yes.
Which came packaged with Chrono Trigger, and that was the worst. The U.S. version of that game was absolutely the worst. Load times, even for battles, it was just –
I hear that was because of the way they had to translate it.
They injected, like, the U.S. script into it.
Running on top of code. Yeah.
Bad.
So Final Fantasy IV was Tosei for the PlayStation.
Yes.
And so – Tosei has done good jobs and they have done bad jobs. And Final Fantasy IV on PlayStation was bad job.
Bad.
But
then they remade the game for WonderSwan and
– they did.
Yeah.
What was your quick digression?
Well, I've told this story before, but in 2000, we were doing a cross-country trip and I went to, like, Wyoming or whatever. And, you know, because there's, like, freaking nothing between Minnesota and Wyoming, we installed, like, a TV in the car that ran off the battery and with a PlayStation.
Oh my God.
And I was – playing games on the PlayStation, watching movies on the PlayStation because, you know, whatever. And, well, I was playing Final Fantasy Anthology and I was playing Final Fantasy V. And funny thing, when you turned off the TV, it also turned off the PlayStation. And so I'm like – my dad, like, parked. And he's like, you got to stop now. I'm like, hold on. I'm going to save.
Yep.
I'm like saving and he's like, screw this. Turns off the car. Memory file corrupted.
Oh, no.
That was the furthest
that's
I
the
ever
worst.
Got in Final Fantasy V.
Oh, yikes. No.
Yeah.
I'm so sorry to hear
Well, that's
that.
What I get for playing a freaking PlayStation in a car off the car battery.
Yeah.
All right. So the WonderSwan color version is –
oh, because they were originally going to do it on the WonderSwan black and white.
Oh, were they?
They showed
that's
off
right.
WonderSwan
yeah, yeah.
black and white Final Fantasy IV before they even did Final Fantasy I and II for the color.
That's right.
And then they canceled that.
And that was such a – like Final Fantasy I, II, and IV – on WonderSwan were such a kind of moment because that system didn't come to the U.S.
It did not.
And not Square was in arrears with Nintendo at the time. So there was no way those games were ever coming to a Nintendo system. No, sir.
And portable Final Fantasy? Oh, my God. It was such a perfect idea.
Well, we totally lost out.
Well, that was why Square wanted back in with Nintendo. It wasn't because they wanted to make GameCube games. It was because they realized they could port their Final Fantasy.
Man, this WonderSwamp thing is going nowhere.
Yep. So that's what happened.
So then we got Final Fantasy IV Advance.
Game Boy Advance.
And didn't Nintendo publish that?
In the U.S.
In the U.S.
And probably in Europe.
And they
published all of them. Yeah.
The first one I beat. Which nice. So I played Final Fantasy II, but continuing on my save game woes, halfway through the game, the battery of Final Fantasy II on the cartridge died.
Wow!
So I was like, "Oh, okay." So I put it away for quite a while, but then FF4 Advance came out on the GBA, and I got it, and I played it and thoroughly enjoyed it. Of course, Final Fantasy IV Advance, like as we were already discussing, had it was like a return to kind of the classic version. It was almost a definitive version, but it also had some real problems with the ATB system.
Yeah, so there was a bug in the American version, fixed for the European version, where the timing was off. And sometimes the game would just not register your command inputs. But it also sometimes wouldn't register enemy command inputs. So it actually balanced out, but it did create kind of a hiccup. But besides that, that version was really, really good. Mm-hmm. Like they really – it wasn't just a port of the game. It was a comprehensive – expanded port. Mm-hmm. I have really fond memories of this game because that was just after I had really become a real member of the video games press. I'd been, OneUp for like a year, but I'd gone from being graphic designer guy to editor who was allowed to play video games. And now I could even do reviews for EGM. So they gave me a GBA lockbox with this game.
Which I took it
home.
To have.
Yeah, I took it home over Thanksgiving break, which apparently you weren't supposed to do with lockboxes, but
no.
I didn't realize that because no one told me. And so I remember going to Mark McDonald's Thanksgiving party and playing the game on the way over there and playing it, and everyone was kind of gathered around watching me play this old Final Fantasy game, but everyone was like, "Oh, that's really great." And it has all this extra content. So first of all, the biggest change at the beginning, initially, is one, it's the Japanese version of the game with an English script, a comprehensively overhauled English script that is coherent and even has in-jokes in it. It's great. But it restores all the content that was missing from Final Fantasy II. And then when you get to the end of the game, all of a sudden you have the ability to choose your party. You can go up to the Tower of Prayer in Mysidia, and all the characters who are not dead, so everyone but Tella, is there hanging out.
Yep.
And you can switch them in and out of your party so you can go into the final dungeon with whatever party you want as long as Cecil's there. And so that changes everything. You suddenly have this flexibility to play through the end of the game in a different way. Once you beat the game, then there are extra dungeons, and each character has his or her own dungeon that is specifically built around that character's abilities. And some of them are fairly standard, but then you have Cid's dungeon where you're actually playing Crazy Taxi with an airship, and you're flying all around the world map, and people are saying, "I need to get to this place in X amount of time." And so you take off and you have to fly across the world map in a limited amount of time. It's ridiculous, but just there's all this different stuff you can do. And then there is kind of the ultimate final dungeon, which is really, really just it just keeps going and going. And when you get to the end, then you fight Zeromus Easy Type. And it's just this.
So did you do all of the extra content?
I did all this stuff on the lockbox. I didn't even get to save it.
Oh,
I didn't get to
God.
Keep it. It was on the review ROM, but I loved it so much. I was like, this is great. I love this. And I don't think all the other versions of the game have had that extra content.
FSP does.
Does it? Okay.
Yep.
Okay, yeah.
Because I kind of burned out on the game with that playthrough, because I plumbed the depths of that game.
Well, the PSP version has pretty much everything that the GBA version does, as well as after year. Plus, it fixes the bugs.
Yes. So that would be the version to play.
That's the definitive version.
The Game Boy version, sometimes characters would skip a turn, right?
Yeah.
Sometimes I feel like playing Final Fantasy V on the Game Boy, I'd get an extra turn. But I don't know if I'm misremembering that or not.
The GBA
one. That doesn't sound right.
I got FF5 on the GBA, which is a total digression. But That's kind of the definitive one as well.
It is. It has some slowdown and some audio issues, but other than that, it's good.
Oh, so you did play through Final Fantasy V on GBA. Oh,
yeah. Okay. Right. That was the furthest I got on the anthology.
Anthology, okay.
Because the load screens were so horrible.
I'm sorry. Yeah, you missed out on Wyvern.
Good times.
But then it kept coming out for stuff even after the PSP.
And Salsa. Well, we can talk about that in the Final Fantasy V episode.
Because it came out on iOS. Or no, it came out on DS.
Final Fantasy IV?
Yeah.
Yeah, but the DS game is a completely different Final Fantasy IV.
And it's a
head-to-toe reinvention, and it is hard as hell.
Yeah.
It is a game that will chew you up, spit you out, and then kick your ass for good measure. Mm-hmm.
And it had additional mechanics as well.
It did. It had a really crazy system where you would get these like skills that you could permanently assign to a character.
Right.
And once you use that skill, it was stuck to that character forever. And that was important because you could do New Game Plus twice. And so only twice though.
Yeah.
Like the third time, you were done. That was it. But every time you replayed it, those characters would carry through those skills.
Right.
Or something. There was something along those lines. So you could have like the ultimate party at the end if you built the characters right.
Mm-hmm.
It was – yeah, like it was all 3D graphics. It had voiced cutscenes.
They gave 3D it 3D graphics.
Yeah, but you know, for DS,
it's DS.
It looked good on DS. When I played it when it was brand new, I imported it, and I was like, "This looks nice. This is good." Not so much now, but I mean, you know, for the time, on the platform. But it had like an Ivalice style localization, much more serious and sort of archaic English. It was
no more like, something awful references, basically.
I don't think so. No, it was much more like the Japanese script was expanded too. Mm. It was not just, you know, like liberties taken in localization. Like it was a, you know, the Japanese version was different too. It was like sort of the definitive version by Takashi Tokita.
This is why we have so many versions of Final Fantasy IV, because it's a small, simple game. You know, it's like, oh, okay, you can do a Wonderswan version. You can take it, tear it all apart and put it back together and like build a new game out of it for the Nintendo DS. You know, you can easily put it on PSP and whatever else.
Yep.
Yep.
Yeah, so that version is pretty crazy. And like I said, some of the boss battles are just –
yeah.
What is happening? And even the standard battles, like you get into a new tower or something and things just tear you apart.
So importantly, that is a different game. Like when we're talking about Final Fantasy IV, we are not talking about the DS game Final Fantasy IV.
That is a new game built on the bones of the old.
Right, right. Not to say it's bad, it's just different.
No, I think it's great. It's really good if you, say, like me, had burned yourself out on Final Fantasy IV through the years.
Yep.
This was a chance to revisit it and really take a fresh start to it.
Mm-hmm.
And I wish they had done this with more of the Final Fantasy games. But, you know, I asked them about that and Tokita said, like, well, you know, I worked on Final Fantasy III, Final Fantasy IV. Like, those were originally my games.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not comfortable going into 5 and 6 and changing those up because those were not my creations. Right. I don't feel like I have the right to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So that's ultimately why we never saw remakes of those games, even though it made perfect sense. Because, like, the people who, you know, I guess Hiroyuki Ito or Yoshinori Kitase didn't want to do them.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if they had been Tokita games, he would have been like, let's go for it. So instead he made the After Years and Final Fantasy Dimensions.
Oh, my God. So, okay. The freaking After Years. So first of all, the After Years was a mobile game. It was a Japanese feature phone game originally. And so, of course, you look at it, because I remember seeing it at Tokyo Game Show and, like, playing a little bit of it on a Japanese feature phone. And I was like, well, I'll never, ever, ever play this game because, of course, Japanese phones and U.S. phones at that point, never the twain shall meet.
But then they brought it to WiiWare.
And then they brought it – yeah, they brought it to WiiWare. That happened.
Yes, it did.
So on WiiWare, they just used the graphics from the SNES Final Fantasy game. So, I mean, it looked – like, it's like, oh my God, they created a sequel to Final Fantasy IV using the original graphics and music and everything. And oh my God, this is incredible. Then you find out a couple of things. One, they split it all up into chapters, so it doesn't really feel like an RPG.
Right.
It feels like all these little mini sort of
things.
Yeah,
little episodes.
You know, based on the fact that it kind of came from
If any Final Fantasy could afford to be broken up like that, it would be Final Fantasy IV.
True. Very true, because the original game, yep. But it was still kind of a mess, and I tried to play it on WiiWare, but I got through a couple of chapters, and I was just like, oh, God, I cannot do this.
None of it stuck with me, except I just remember, like, the game balance felt really off.
It is, yeah.
Like they, did they play test this at all?
Maybe not.
It's possible. Because it's a mobile game, who cares?
And so that was kind of – that was, like, a really just sort of a sad, like, you know – dragging the game's corpse out, you know, for and
I avoided it like the plague because I have so many fond memories of Final Fantasy IV, and yeah. I really didn't need like a cheap, as you said, dragging the corpse out rehash that was originally designed for mobile and eventually got put on WiiWare. I did not need that in my life. And I remember back in the day there was talk about Final Fantasy VI-2 and people were like, oh, well, I wonder if they would make Final Fantasy sequels. And then we kind of discovered what that world is like.
Maybe you don't want
that. Oh, Dirge of Cerberus, the after years. Let's not have any more
and
sequels.
And then we realized that it was a lot like Disney sequels. Like,
yes, aftermarket
Little
or
Maid
after
Return
years was direct to market.
To the sea. That's Final Fantasy IV after years.
Right.
Yes.
Right. I wish Final Fantasy IV, the after years, would return to the sea.
One more note on ports. It also came out on iOS and Steam. And it was more or less based on the DS version. But they also had their own changes
that
included like a side quest like the search for the 8 Eidolons. And
Yeah, you can play Final Fantasy IV a lot if you want.
You can play Final Fantasy IV on pretty much any platform you want.
Yeah.
Like any modern platform. You can play it on PlayStation because you can get it on PSN. Mm-hmm. You can get it on – I think you can get it on the Wii. Like you can download it because you get 6.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you can play Wii on Wii U.
Yeah, if I were to – so what version would you recommend? Because I would tell people if they were playing it for the very first time.
PSP.
If you, I think if you have
PSP
a PlayStation
and then
Vita,
DS.
Because it's not – the sprites are redrawn, but they're redrawn with pixels. They're not redrawn as like really gross blobby
things. It's pretty. Yeah, I mean, it looks
really
good.
Yeah, it does look good. The auto battle is nice. It's really – you know, there's a few, you know, extra sort of
– It's kind of the purest version that you're going to get.
It is very pure.
If
it
you play the pure. Original SNES – if you play the SNES North American version, not only is the local localization horrible,
it's not
but
good.
Yeah, there's just like it's so different from the original Japanese version. It's like I'm playing, like I said, playing it for the Let's Play. I'm like, this is a really fascinating experience. I'm learning so much about Final Fantasy IV that I didn't know. I wouldn't necessarily recommend it to anybody.
So
fun,
here's a listener mail section letter from Andrew Ryan that interjects an interesting opinion. Mm-hmm. He says, man, the after years is hot garbage, but that interlude chapter is actually pretty solid. I wanted to say my piece and defend a nice, if not perfect, add-on episode that was better than expected. Do you guys play the interlude?
I played like I played some of the interlude. I don't know if it's as good as all that. I mean, I played it and I'm like, oh, okay, it's reusing Final Fantasy sprites to, you know, tell another little sort of story again. It's not – because it's not all broken up like the after years, I guess it's better. But I guess by the time I started playing the interlude, I just finished playing Final Fantasy IV and I was a little burned out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I can see that. Declan Fair says, ports and versions aside, I feel like – Final Fantasy IV really represented a turning point for the series, as this is where the series really started pushing technological limits and focusing on narrative presentation with its heavy focus on characters and, indeed, romance, which were rarely touched on in games at that point. I suppose that actually began with 2, but 4 had the technology to bring that to the forefront, and its more traditional leveling system combined with more refined combat kept people more engaged in both the story and game. It really is impressive to look at 4 and compare it to other console RPGs that came out around the same time, as they seem rather simple in comparison, although it would soon be eclipsed by other games, including its immediate successor.
A couple of things. I was reflecting on the fact that Final Fantasy IV holds up so well. Like, there's so many games from that time, like, were actually quite primitive, and RPGs especially so, because RPGs were, like, you know, the kind of purest expression of game mechanics that you were going to find at that time. And they were like kind of almost put together by engineers, and they didn't necessarily care about a wonderful user experience. So Final Fantasy IV, by that context, was like actually really accessible and really wonderful. And in that respect, that's why it's still fun to play. Another thing is like back in those days, I can't stress enough what like how different Final Fantasy IV was compared to like all of the other fare that was coming out at that time. Like we differentiated, especially on console, RPGs from other games by the fact that it had a story. Having a story, having any kind of drama whatsoever was a big freaking deal on consoles back at that time because everything was shoot 'em up, puzzle game, maybe a simulation, maybe platformers. Platformers dominated everything, and you just didn't have a story outside of like a nice little opening introductory cutscene. And so Final Fantasy IV comes out and is telling you a full-blown dramatic story, however simple it is, and to your average console player, that was a big freaking deal.
Yeah, Final Fantasy IV was not the first Super NES RPG, but what the hell was even happening in Draken? Like, that game, I do not get it. Like, you're walking around and then a giant dog head appears from the ground and kills you.
Yeah.
What? No, Final Fantasy IV was like... solid. It was really, really well made, and it made sense. I can't say that for Draken, which maybe was cool in the original PC version that came out in Europe. Yeah. I mean, the Super NES version is just like, what? What?
For me, Final Fantasy IV, like in my real experience, Final Fantasy IV is the beginning of the Final Fantasy series. You know, like I played some Final Fantasy I and then abandoned it. We never got Final Fantasy II. We never got Final Fantasy III. So for me, Final Fantasy IV was like the first Final Fantasy game that I played all the way through. And to play the games that are any earlier than that, it does not capture – that doesn't feel to me like playing a Final Fantasy game. Like this really set down what a modern Final Fantasy game is.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, and even compared to other RPGs that came out at that time, like Phantasy Star II – great games, but a lot of people would say, well, these games are kind of esoteric and like you have to be really a fan to be able to appreciate them now.
Yeah, Phantasy Star 2 is padded out a lot with big confusing dungeons. Final Fantasy 4 just cuts the fat. That's really a great thing about it. Mm-hmm. I have one more letter from Juan from Bogota who says, hello, Retronauts crew. Here's an unusual take on Final Fantasy 4. The game probably helped me learn English and eventually become a professional translator. Yes, I really mean that, despite having an infamously sloppy localization that felt a little odd, even in the eyes of a second language student. The bulk of the game's narrative was surprisingly readable. More importantly, its dramatic story full of theatrics and colorful character development maintained my interest and awakened my curiosity about unfamiliar terms, which can be extremely helpful for young boys who want to put their growing English skills into practice outside of a boring old classroom. Looking through the manual and rereading the game's coverage in Nintendo publications over the years also had a positive influence. So there you go. Like, mm-hmm. We can slam the game for its terrible localization, and indeed it was terrible.
But you know what?
But it was serviceable.
Yeah.
And I guess, you know, maybe it's like a good sort of like starting point for someone who is still learning the language themselves.
Right.
That's cool.
You got kids to read.
It did.
Yeah. It was kind of the baseline back then,
before Pokemon, anyway. There was Final Fantasy IV.
I think what the market research that Square was probably looking at that time that led them towards Mystic Quest and things like that was that, like, the average age of the person who owned and always and, like, you know, regularly played the Super Nintendo was probably
and responded
younger
to
than
Nintendo
it was in Japan.
Power Poles.
Yeah.
Could be.
Yep.
All right. So any other thoughts on Final Fantasy IV before we call it a day?
One of the best RPGs ever made.
It felt bigger when I was younger. You know, it felt like it was this massive, expansive thing. But now to replay it as an adult, it's like, ooh, that's a fast game.
It's a fast, short game. It's funny. But, I mean, it's one of those situations where, you know, like everything that has come since builds on that. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, of course it seems a little slight in retrospect.
Say,
but it was it was such a – like it hit so hard at the time.
Foundational is a good word for it.
Yeah.
Though I was just looking through release dates and I realized that Phantasy Star 2 actually came out like a couple years earlier than Final Fantasy IV. So in that respect,
that was 89.
Yeah, Phantasy Star II like had that sprawling narrative on console long before Final Fantasy IV. But I feel like maybe Final Fantasy IV ultimately stuck more in the popular imagination. You can blame Sega for that, whatever. But in terms of, but yeah, foundational is the way that I would put Final Fantasy IV. And I think the fact that it holds up so well and it's so fun to play, almost no matter what platform you play it on, really speaks to just the how well they utilize the mechanics, how like engaging the battle system really is, despite the fact that by RPG standards, extremely limited, extremely linear. It's just I really appreciate it playing through it again. And it's almost one of those RPGs that I could just go back to at any time. And it really helps, of course, that it goes by so fast. But as I already said, it didn't feel rushed. Like, it establishes so much. It lays so much groundwork. And yet, like, I look back and I'm like, wow, man, all that happened in 5 hours. But at the same time, I'm like, but that's okay. Yeah.
All right. So thanks, Kat. Thanks, Chris and Bob, for coming in.
And Bob.
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 Bob's not here. So where can we find you guys on the internet?
You can find me at US Gamer, where I am the editor-in-chief or something.
How's about that?
How about that? And probably right now I'm like flying around like in Europe or something. I don't know when this episode is going to be released. But yeah, you should check out my – if you like me talking about RPGs, you should check out my RPG podcast, Axe of the Blood God, which is US Gamer's official RPG podcast every week. Nadia Oxford and I talk about all of the relevant RPG news, whatever is coming out. And I think that this would be very relevant to Retronauts fans because we talk a lot about Japanese games. I mean, we talk about – we love all RPGs. Like the Blood God loves all RPGs, but we especially tend to cover Japanese games. So
yeah, note that that's the official US Gamer RPG podcast. Don't listen to the unofficial US Gamer RPG podcast.
Avoid that
that's
one.
That's what got me fired.
You can come and find me on Twitter. My Twitter handle is Kobunheat, KobunHeat. If you want to find out what I am up to at any given moment.
And as for myself, I'm doing Retronauts. So thanks for listening to my work. Retronauts, of course, is supported through hopefully advertisement and also Patreon. You can support us on Patreon at patreon.com/retronauts. And /GameSpite. One is podcasts, one is videos. I work on both, and that's how I'm investing my time. So please feed me and my wife. It'll be great. You can find me on Twitter as GameSpite. You can find Retronauts on Twitter as Retronauts, also on Facebook, Tumblr, I don't know what else. We're around. So check us out. Get our podcast as a subscription on iTunes. That would be cool. Leave a review for us on iTunes. That would also be cool, especially if it's not one star. And yeah, thanks for listening. Please continue listening and tell your friends about us because I like having food to eat. So thanks again. We'll be back next week with another full episode because that's what we do now. And we will talk about something other than Final Fantasy IV. Thank you.
The Mueller Report. I'm Ed Donahue with an AP News Minute. President Trump was asked at the White House if Special Counsel Robert Mueller's Russia investigation report should be released next week when he will be out of town.
I guess from what I understand, that will be totally up to the Attorney General.
Maine's Susan Collins says she would vote for a congressional resolution disapproving of President Trump's emergency declaration to build a border wall, becoming the first Republican senator to publicly back it. In New York, the wounded supervisor of a police detective killed by friendly fire was among the mourners attending his funeral. Detective Brian Simonson was killed as officers started shooting at a robbery suspect last week. Commissioner James O'Neill was among the speakers today at Simonson's funeral.
It's a tremendous weight to bear, knowing that your choices will directly affect the lives of others. But cops like Brian don't shy away from it. It's the very foundation of who they are and what they do.
The robbery suspect and a man police say acted as his lookout have been charged with murder. I'm Ed Donahue.